Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started with today's great guest, I just want to encourage people to like and subscribe to the channel, either on YouTube or wherever you are listening. It really does help us to get the word out, and more people can find out about the great guests we're having and the various podcasts we're doing here. So make sure you hit that subscribe button and like this video or podcast, however you're listening or seeing it. Okay, so today's guest I'm very excited about, Daria Little. She is a convert from Islam to Catholicism, but it's not quite that simple, as we'll find out in today's discussion. I've been following Daria for a number of years. I've read her book here. I'll put her book up on the screen here for those who are watching, From Islam to Christ. Daria was born and raised in Turkey, and she, like I said, she grew up Muslim. As a teenager, she became an atheist. Her religious wanderings continued, however, and she eventually converted to Christianity as a Protestant. And then finally, the Lord brought her home into the Catholic Church. She's the author of From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God, and A Beginner's Guide to the Traditional Latin Mass. So we'll mention that. We'll talk about that too later. I have read From Islam to Christ. It's excellent. And I'm a little embarrassed to say, I went to look for the book that so I could have it prepared beforehand, and I've let somebody borrow it, and I don't remember who has it. So that's how much I liked it, though. When I really like a book, I tell other people about it, and then I end up losing it because they end up with it. So anyway, so Daria, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Eric.
Great. So obviously, what I'd like to talk about first is your background. It's very fascinating. You know, people like me who converted from Protestantism to Catholicism, we got nothing on you. I mean, you have the, you know, almost every step of the process here. So why don't you first tell us about your upbringing as a Muslim in Turkey?
Okay. Well, I want to start with that I've been wrong many times. That's but I, you know, finally I got here and the Lord has been very patient with me. Okay. So my Turkey's a little bit different than other Muslim countries in the Middle East. It's a little more secular, especially on the outside. It's changed a lot since I moved to America with our current president. So I grew up, when I grew up, my parents were Muslims, of course, because it's part of our national identity, like everybody needs to be Muslim, but neither of them really practiced. My mother was a little more observant than my father. So we all kind of, during the summer, we would go to the mosque and learn how to read the Quran and memorize all the prayers in Arabic. Like, I don't speak Arabic. We could enunciate the words, read it, but we never knew what they meant because, you know, but you need to pray in Arabic in Islam for it to be beneficial, you know, for it to count, basically. So that's how I grew up here. And in the winter, we went to our public school and we learned about all these Western ideas of secularism and democracy. And then it was kind of almost like, looking back, almost like it was schizophrenic. Like Turkey is stuck between East and the West. And that's how my upbringing was. But I never questioned it. I never knew anybody who was not Muslim. It's a very homogeneous country as far as the religion goes. So I never questioned anything. So, and the family life, I suppose that's very relevant to my conversion. It was still very dominated by Muslim values. So like my mother was a nurse, but she was still, she would come back home and she would still do everything all on her own because, you know, as a woman, that's what she's supposed to do. And, you know, she had to come home, prepare 3 courses of meals, you know, wash our clothes by hand. And there was no equality that a lot of Westerners take for granted, especially for a working woman. So she was kind of always miserable. And of course, there is a gender hierarchy in Islam. So that was very pronounced in our family as well. But like none of this, I really, it bothered me or like I never questioned, because it's a very communal, still very communal culture. And their social pressures are a lot stronger than they are in America. So you just don't question it. And another factor of me not questioning was that Islam, I try to explain, thrives on what St. Thomas called servile fear. So from a young age, you're always taught that, okay, Allah is the master and you're the slave, and you always know your place. And if you don't, he will smite you, kill you, you'll burn in hell, like all these really vivid punishment imagery. I actually opened the book with one of these when I was a little girl. There was all of these really big boulders next to the creek I walked past every day when I went to school. And one of the things you're not supposed to do in Islam, which you're probably familiar with, that you're not supposed to depict Allah or Muhammad. And as a little girl, I was like trying to imagine what Allah would actually look like. And then I realized that I did this really bad thing. And I was worried for 3 days that I was going to be turned into a boulder, like the big ones. Wow. Like, because you're just, that fear is instilled in you from such a young age. So, and then also that becomes part of you. And then as you grow up, you never question, you don't even dare to question, which is, you know, we can talk about it later. One of the reasons Muslim lands are so resistant to the gospel.
Right. Now, I something you said made me think of a similar, when I was young, this is more in high school, I had a conversion to Christ, and I really felt guilty about my sins. But because I was Protestant, I didn't have a confession to go to, so I never was quite sure if God forgave me. In Islam, if you're a little girl and you feel like you've done something terrible, is there any process in which those sins are forgiven? Like, how do you overcome that?
Well, you ask for forgiveness, but Islam doesn't have a consistent theology of sin. Like, there's no original sin, and it's a nominalistic religion in that a sin is a sin because Allah says so, and tomorrow he can change his mind and that's not a sin anymore. So it's like, it's not a very consistent understanding of sin. Like, when you live in in a structure like that, you ask for forgiveness, but it's all very on the surface. Right. So you basically try not to get caught. So because there's a lot of shame and social pressure. But if you can get away with it, people will still sin. And there isn't, like, in a way, honesty isn't that deep. It is, because the Lord created all of us to yearn for that honesty. Right. But Islam doesn't necessarily encourage it, if that makes sense. So forgiveness is, you ask for forgiveness and you assume that you're forgiven, hopefully, and you try to do some good deeds to counteract your sin.
So it's like a penance.
Yes. So, yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't call it that, but it's in a way.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I think the penance is more like, you can never atone for your own sin because it's all, you know, but it's more like, to show your, I may be wrong, to show that you're truly sorry. And okay, you kind of like, okay, I will do this sacrifice to show that I am, you know, sorry. Whereas in Islam, it's more like a scale. Okay, I've done this bad thing and now right, let me do this good thing to kind of, because they say at the day of the judgment, your good deeds and your sins will be scaled and you're going to go to heaven and or hell according to whatever is heavier, because obviously they don't have a savior, you know.
Which is interesting, because that's kind of the stereotypical kind of poorly formed Christian attitude in the West, is this idea that, okay, you're just going to be balanced and you go to heaven if you do more good than bad. And it's very works-based, which is essentially what Islam actually believes. Now, another thing you mentioned I wanted to ask. So in Turkey, is it common for Muslim women to work outside the home?
It's a lot more common than other Muslim countries. Yeah, okay. I would say.
But then there's still the expectation of doing everything at home as you would, right, regardless of whether you work or not.
Yes, which I can't imagine. You know, I have five kids. I can't like the house is a mess now. So I can imagine going to work and cleaning up the house and cooking meals. Like, I just can't imagine. It's like, hey, Turkish woman, here is the worst of everything.
So. Oh, geez. Now, so your family is essentially nominally is Muslim. Did you ever have like, you know, you had the feelings of guilt because you might have done something wrong, but did you ever feel like you were a, like, was it ever a time before you eventually left to become atheist that you felt like this is who you identified primarily as Muslim, or was it always more of a nationalistic kind of like a cultural thing?
No. So as I mentioned, every summer we went to these schools, and I was very good at enunciating the Quran. And I started to hang out with a lot more people who are more devout. I want to say when I was eight or nine, that I really wanted to like cover my hair, you know, just wear the hijab, like, and then like go to the mosque everywhere for prayers. At that time I was already observing the Ramadan fast, the third month long fast. So yes, I had internalized it, if that's the word.
Yes, right.
But I think that's the age, like I look at my kids now, I can see that spiritual awakening starts around age 7. Right. And I think I was around 8 and 9, and my parents just told me I wasn't allowed to cover my hair. Because like back then, like you need to be Muslim, but not too Muslim. It's really confusing. you weren't allowed in public buildings if you wore the hijab, or universities or schools like that. So they didn't want me to be an outcast in that sense. But yeah, definitely it became a lot more of my life than my parents' life at, you know, one summer.
Right, right. Is it still like that in Turkey as far as like, or has it become more Muslim?
Yeah, it's definitely, more Muslim. Okay. Last 15 years or so, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so, but eventually, and I think as a teenager, if I remember correctly, you end up becoming an atheist. So how did that go from, you obviously had some religious awakening, some religious intuitions early on, but then you end up leaving religion altogether?
I don't think I would have left Islam looking back if my parents didn't get a divorce. Like I would have never questioned, you know, I talked about that servile fear. You're surrounded with that wall of fear that you kind of need a really strong impact to break it, almost like create a crack. And divorce was very uncommon. It's a lot more common, unfortunately, now. Back then, my parents were the only divorced parents that I knew of in the small town I lived. I mean, I say small town, but it was 150,000 people living closer to each other. So, when they got a divorce, and it was really a messy divorce. My father had always cheated on my mom, and now he wanted to marry somebody else alongside of my mom. Even though it's illegal, people still kind of do it. Like they use the Muslim religious ceremony. So anyway, and he said he would never leave us, and he left the following day, and we didn't hear from them forever. And then my mom was in the depths of depression. Now he was this divorced woman who was kind of slightly ostracized. Right. So that's when I started to question everything, because if they didn't love me enough to stay together, you know, as a child, the whole world revolves around you. You don't understand that your parents' marriage is not all about you, right? So I was like, okay, if they didn't love me enough to stay together, that means they lied to me about their life. What else did they lie about? Mm-hmm. And then that's the first time I really started to question. And that was the impact for me to question Islam. And I had never read the Quran or the Hadith in Turkish. And with that question in mind, like, is this true? Is this religion true? When I started to read all those in Turkish with a questioning mind, I realized that Muhammad was not somebody I could follow. I mean, as a woman, I can't follow him, obviously. But also, it's like, you know, we were always taught that he never waged offensive wars. Everything he did was defensive. And you read history, you're like, that's not true. And then you read the way women were treated even from the beginning. And then you're like, this is, how can I be a woman and then still be part of this, you know, this religion. So I slowly fell away from Islam and I became an atheist just because there wasn't any other option. I basically like put all the religions together. I mean, Buddhism and Eastern religions, they never appealed to me. I am not a relativist in a way. I don't, you know, I'm like, there's one truth. And if there is no God, we just need to be miserable altogether, you know? So, so I pushed it aside, basically all religion, and I ended up an atheist. So like,
so at that point there was no consideration of Christianity or anything like that, right?
You know, no. And looking back, I wonder why I didn't question Islam's teaching, because we were always taught that, yeah, you know, Allah sent a prophet David to Jews and the Jews corrupted his teachings. Then Allah sent prophet Jesus to Christians and Christians corrupted his teachings. Then Allah finally sent Muhammad and it's all like preserved. So I always believe that, like we were told that Christians believed in three gods, Father, Son, and the Mother, which is like not true, but it is in the Quran, you know, that's what it says. So I never questioned it. I figured, oh, they were coming from the all same imagined made up God. Right. Does it make sense? So, yes. And I didn't know any Christians to tell me otherwise.
Right. Now, as an atheist, it sounds like you kind of fell into it a little bit. Did you ever at any point in your atheism become like a more hardcore atheist who was like telling other Muslims you need to be atheist or anything like that? Or was it more just a matter of it was in the background, like, okay, now I don't have to worry about religion. I can just live my life.
I think maybe I was definitely militant. If you ask my opinion, I would make fun of you and tell you how wrong you were. I found a little group of people who were similarly cynical and atheistic in their beliefs. And it's definitely become my own religion in a way. And I clung to it. And I read the writings of those contemporary Turkish atheists. So but I wasn't like, let all become atheists. Right. It was more like, hey, you know, you're wrong, I'm right. And I was a little depressed as a teenager, as you can imagine from. Right. So, yeah.
Now, did that have any social consequences for you? And obviously being Muslim is almost like being Turkish. I mean, they're almost the same thing, it sounds like. Did that have social consequences for you that you are now outwardly atheist? Or did you have to hide it sometimes or anything like that?
No, I didn't. Actually, it was much easier to be an atheist in Turkey than a Christian, funnily enough, because like atheists are in a way, I don't know, like nobody's that against atheists. I don't know. I never felt persecuted or anything like that. No, I don't. I wouldn't say my religious. We have to take religious education in middle school and high school. My religion teachers were really upset that I was an atheist, but I knew all the answers because I had that, you know,
your summer classes.
Quran. I had memorized like half of the Quran in Arabic by then. So like I could answer anything they asked. I would say as an atheist, that was the worst persecution I had to endure. Like I was kicked out of the class for my smart comments a few times, but you know, one can survive with those. It's okay.
That's right. We've all been there. So for various reasons. So, okay. So that was as a teenager. And then the next step is you ended up converting to Christianity. And to me, of the four, well, obviously you just were born Muslim, of the three changes, mm-hmm. this one to me seems like the biggest jump, because falling from Islam into atheism, lots of people fall away from religion. Mm-hmm. Going from Protestant to Catholic, I mean, frankly, that seems, I mean, makes sense to me because that's what I did. And stuff. Right. But going from atheist to, with a background in Islam, to mm-hmm. Protestant Christianity, I think you were living in Turkey at the time. I can't remember now. Seems like a big jump. So could you kind of say how in the world, I mean, obviously God's grace is how it happened, but how did that happen?
Yeah, not reluctantly, my friend. I did not want to become a Christian. But so I had to work because like in Turkey, parents support their children until basically they get their own job. But, you know, broken family. So I had to work and I found a job as a tutor to this American lady. Little did I know, she was a missionary. She was raised by atheists and she converted when she was in college. 5-point Calvinist. I mean, I love her to pieces. And she left her a lucrative job in New York City to come preach the gospel in Turkey. Wow. You know,
we need somebody more Catholics doing. We need Catholics doing that. That's just as incredible.
Yes. And it's like, I'm so glad our Protestant brethren took up that slack that we left behind in the last, 60 years or so. So the first time I meet her, this is like, she opens the door and this is Turkey in Ankara. I was getting my undergrad. She opens the door and there's a scripture verse behind her, embroidered, like behind her front door in Turkish. It says, "There's no salvation under heaven except by his name," from the book of Acts.
Wow.
And I'm like, poor lady. She's a Christian.
Right. She's not hiding.
I was so sure, you know, I was just so, I'm 19. I clearly know everything by then. Right. I'm like, let me cure you of this disease. And it's funny, like people are so reluctant about talking to Muslims about religion and politics. Like, you know, in Muslim countries, I'm like, what else is there to talk about? Let's talk about it, you know? So I was the one who initiated the conversation. So I started working for her. And for 3.5 years, I saw her twice a week, 2.5 hours a day. This is for while I'm teaching her Turkish. And often the conversation extended beyond that. And she, for the first time, showed me a different God, if that makes sense. Because the God I knew, Allah, was capricious, inconsistent. He could change any moment, right? Like, it was just like, you didn't know what to expect from him. Whereas God, the Father, is completely different. He's consistent. He loves us. And he was above and beyond this created universe, if that makes sense. Like, Allah was a little too small. Like, he was just he was really bothered with science and scientific facts and all that stuff, because Quran could be proven wrong, if that makes sense. Like, I mean, it's a little hard to explain, whereas this God she was talking about was above and beyond that. Like, she kind of opened my eyes to the possibility of a God who can coexist, if you can if you can forgive the phrase, with science. Because by then I was reading a lot. Like, you know, in high school, I'm so geeky, playing chess, reading quantum physics. So, like, you know, so she showed me a different God. And I would say she's Therese in my book. That was her biggest accomplishment, in a way, in my spiritual walk, that it is possible that God exists. And for me, if he actually exists, that's a big deal, right? Then if there is eternity, then our life here is like this, and it's gone, and it has eternal consequences if what she said was true. So that's how far she brought me to the foot of Christ.
And I've been working in evangelization for over 20 years, and so I'm always fascinated in conversion stories more because of the person who is the influence of the person being converted. So this woman sounds just fascinating to me. Was there anything in particular? I mean, it was a process. It was an over 3-year process. But do you remember anything in particular that she might have said or done that really, you look back and you say, that was a turning point? Might not have been the day you converted, but it was like, that really made I started looking a different direction then.
She was the first pro-life person I met. And that was a big deal for me. I mean, obviously, I was living a very immoral life, but also she presented a coherent argument towards pro-life issues. And I remember finding that fascinating, and I was not in the least pro-life. But what really impressed me with her demeanor was also she was okay to say, "I don't know, let me get back to you." I know it's so silly, but I'm like, how do you not know of this and still believe? Because she believed that, you know, somebody else had come up with some answer. So that was like, those were the two things that really affected me. With her, there is no special turning point. Right. It was definitely because I was so far away from Christianity. Like, I didn't even have a simple understanding of sin. Like, I was a communist at that time, excuse me, who believed that people raped other people because their sexual urges were suppressed by society's unattainable standards. Does it sound familiar, Eric?
Yeah, right.
You know, so, or the poor was poor because the rich in the West wanted to hoard all the money for themselves. So like I had these communistic ideals, and I said, if we come up with this perfect system, this earth can be paradise, which is obviously like not true, you know, because human nature, it's right. Not going to change on this earth. So I was really far away from anything to understand Christianity. And excuse me. And one of my biggest hurdles was the if there's a benevolent God who wasn't capricious like Allah, who actually loved us and cared us and wanted to take care of us, why is there so much evil in the world? And that was a big thing. Like, you're either a liar or you're not omnipotent, right? Like, if you're omnipotent, then it should be, all should be perfect. And so this was my third year. But at the end of my second year in college, I had a professor from America, a Fulbright scholar. He was teaching us advanced English. My education language was in English, for my college. So we had to take all these really, you know, hardcore English courses. And he made us read this old translation of The Grand Inquisitor from Brothers Karamazov. Oh, yeah. And when I read that, I mean, I have a whole chapter in my book, and he basically talks about Christ's temptation in the desert. And for the first time, I faced with my own sinfulness. It was kind of interesting because I'm like reading this old translation with a giant dictionary, too much coffee, middle of the night. And I'm like, the world is evil, not because of God, but because of sin. Right? Like I sin and it affects 10 people. My father's sins, my mother's and my father's sins change the whole direction of my life. So it has this, you know, rippling effect that it's not God's fault. It's our fault. So that was like, it just hit me in the face for the first time. I realized that I'm at the bottom of this well. You remember, like, as you know, Protestants use this analogy a lot. I have no way of saving myself.
Right.
Like somebody else has to come down and save me from this pit of sin that, you know, I put myself in, basically. So that was a major turning point for me. And then I started to work for a different family. This Therese came to America for a sabbatical, and I started to work for a different missionary family. And then in their life, I realized how Christ could change my life. In that, like, I've never seen a family, a functioning family. Like, I am, you know, 20, almost 22 by then. I've never seen a functioning marriage and a functioning family that the husband and wife served each other, loved each other so well. They loved their children, disciplined them in love. The kids didn't lie back. I mean, it was just this wonderfully functioning unit that I had never seen before. And I was like, I want that. Like, I wanted to hang out with them all the time. Like, a few times they had to tell me to leave their house because, look, I don't live there. Like, just go, you know. So it was so beautiful. And I could see that because by then I had all my intellectual questions were answered.
Right.
It was more like this, you know, brain to heart kind of journey. And I still couldn't make up my mind. And you probably are aware of this, that in Muslim lands, a lot of people see dreams and visions of Our Lord or Our Lady. And so I couldn't make up my decision because I was at a very good university in Turkey and I was going to get a really good government job. Finally, I wasn't going to be this poor student who had to work all the time. You know, everything was lined up. But if I become a Christian, I can't get a government job. You know, my boyfriend was an atheist. All my friends are atheists. So I keep worrying about all these like worldly stuff. And one morning I was going to class and the Lord gave me this vision. Like it was very quick. It wasn't a dream. It wasn't really dramatic. It was more like, you know, showed me who I was. So I saw this meadow. This little girl was sitting in the middle of this like vast meadow wearing all white and looking down in her lap, playing with these tiny little toys. And these two hands came down from the sky and just was presenting her this gift. It was like glowing and bright, and you could see that it wasn't something of this world. And the girl didn't even see the gift for a long time. But finally, she looks up and realizes, and she says to the owner of the hands, "No, thank you. I have these little things to play with." And I'm like, "Are you stupid? How could you even compare that gift with those little toys?" So, of course, it's me. Right. You know, that's what I'm doing. So anyway, then the following day, you know, I went to the lady and I said, "This is a good day to become a Christian." And you're right. By far, that was the hardest and longest step, because I feel like with the Protestant, I became a Protestant because I had not met any Catholics who would ever told me the gospel. And I, you know, and I just didn't know any better. And I'm so grateful for them. So, but that was by far the most, I don't know, striking change of my life, because becoming Catholic was like, I just went one more station to reach the destination in a way. Yeah,
this was the biggest jump. So when you became Protestant, when you became a Christian, were you baptized at that point?
Yes. So I became a Christian in October, like pray the prayer, you know.
Right. Yep.
Jesus in your heart kind of prayer. Yep. And then I was baptized in May, the following year, full immersion baptism, and all valid. I mean, like, you know, the formula was there. I'm like, thanks be to God. Unlike some Catholics today, I know that my baptism was
there. I know a lot of people, a lot of converts from Protestantism, when they come to church now, some priests are just conditionally baptizing them all because there's so many problems with that. Right. Unfortunately, you're old enough to remember what was said and everything. Now, what type of church was that? Was it a Presbyterian church? What was it?
I ended up going to this Turkish church, which was Pentecostal. Are you aware of Four Square churches?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So it was one of the Four Square churches, which is the reason I never ended up charismatic Catholic. I think I just saw too much of it.
Yeah.
But that was the Turkish Protestant church I attended back in Ankara. Yeah.
Okay. So how long then were you a practicing Protestant Christian?
Okay, so I started, you know, reading everything. Now I'm learning about Christianity. I had a few questions, like sola scriptura never made sense, sola fide never made sense.
Not very good Protestant.
No, but you know what? I had never thought about these. Like, it's not something you think about until you become a Christian. But I'm like, how can you be sola scriptura when there is no scripture to be sola scriptura about? Like, where did it come from? You know, like. But it didn't, you know, I didn't ask too many questions because I'm like, clearly I don't know enough. So the more I read, these all will make sense to me. So sola scriptura, sola fide didn't make sense. And lack of a magisterium really bothered me. And also I, like, for my whole life, I was like this, like, evolutionist, right? And everybody around me, once I became Protestant, was really hardcore creationist. And I'm like, are you saying God couldn't have used evolution? Not that I was close to the idea of creation, but it was so rigid. It just didn't make sense, because obviously when you're a Protestant, you kind of need to take everything literal in a way, because you don't have a magisterium to tell you what not to and what to do. Does that make sense? It's like,
absolutely.
So anyway, those were the issues. But I'm like, you know, I just need to read a little more to understand. So I started to work for the Turkish church. We ran this camp for Turkish Christian teenagers. And a guy that I worked there, he was a missionary kid. He grew up in Turkey. And he was like, we were close in age. He's 2 years younger than me, studied the same major. And we became good friends through working this teenage camp. And he was studying in Notre Dame. Once he finished it, he came back to Turkey to work in Istanbul. And I was visiting with him and with my agnostic roommate one day. And he's Anthony in my book. I'm like, okay. He says, I'm going to tell you something. Don't be upset. So I brought my agnostic friend, thinking that, like, between Anthony and me, we're going to convince her. Like, we're going to make her Christian. So he's like, I became a Catholic. And I'm like, how dare you? You know, I was so shocked, because Turkey is very anti-Catholic. And I'm surrounded by these, like, all these Protestant Christians who think, you know, the Catholic Church is the whore of Babylon. You know, it's just, like, very anti-Catholic. And I was appalled. Like, so we ended up this whole lunch almost, like, fighting, like, very passionate arguing. And of course, my friend didn't become Christian. Can you imagine? He was like, oh, look, Catholics and Protestants are.
Yeah.
Again. So I go back to my dorm back in Ankara. I'm getting my master's because I figured I get a PhD and come back to Turkey and then I'll get a job. Like private universities, like they don't care what you are as long as you keep your head down. So I go to this really big library. And there was one book on Catholic theology, and it's written by this guy called Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger. I had no idea who he was. Like, I mean, this is how clueless I am. He was the Pope back then, of course.
Yeah.
And I opened it. I was like, it's called Introduction to the Fundamentals of Catholic Theology, I think, published by Ignatius Press. I couldn't even like finish reading the introduction of this introductory book. Like, of course you're not gonna refute Cardinal Ratzinger. So, and Anthony sent me a little tiny book written by Mark Shea.
Okay.
By what authority have you read it? It's like,
yes.
Yeah. This is back then. And
no, it was an excellent book.
Actually. Yeah, no, it was a great book because he pointed out all my questions. And then he like refuted them using the scriptures. And I'm like, oh no, Catholics have all the answers. You know, like, Yeah, it's like, I'm wrong again. It's just like so hard to be wrong all the time. So there are two Catholic churches in Ankara. It's a city of 5 million people. One is in the Vatican on the Vatican embassy grounds and the other one is on the French embassy grounds. But they had mass in Turkish. And I kept calling them so that like somebody would talk to me about this crazy Catholic thing because I was going crazy and it took forever. But I finally got a hold of the 70-year-old French Jesuit and who was sure that I was a government spy who's trying to trap Catholics into, you know, spreading the good news. But he realized I was just a crazy girl who was confused. So anyway, I ended up getting confirmed while I was getting my PhD in England and here I am.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, I always loved Ratzinger's work, but it wouldn't be something I would give first to a potential convert. It's definitely a little bit, you know.
Right? Like, clearly I know better. I'm like, what have you read? Anything. But
So one thing you said that it bothered you as a Protestant not to have a magisterium. I'm sure at the time you didn't know it as a magisterium. You didn't necessarily know that word. Mm-hmm. But why is that? Why did that bother you that there wasn't this authority other than the scriptures to kind of say, here's what we believe?
Right. I could already tell the division among them. I mean, even though like all the Christians I met in Turkey were excellent, like excellent Christians, faithful. I mean, I'm still friends with most of them, like, you know, creme de la creme to become a missionary in Turkey, right? Just wonderful people. But even among them, there were still divisions. And they even didn't agree about some major issues, like, I don't know, you can say gay marriage, or I even heard somebody trying to justify abortion in a way, like on certain occasions, which is not very common. But you could see, like, how can everybody read the same book and arrive at different conclusions? Like, why should I trust the judgment of this random guy who got a degree from some Bible college than like my own or somebody else's? Does it make sense? It just didn't make sense. But the final one was, I was at this Bible study and we were looking through the scriptures to see if we had to believe in the Trinity to become Christians. And everybody else decided that we didn't have to because it wasn't in the Bible. And I'm like, that's a major doctrine. Yeah. Like, you can't just get rid of it. Like, it's been around for so long. So those were the things that really attracted my attention. It's like, by what authority can you tell me what to believe? Like, how can we ever attain unity, you know?
Right. So it sounds like Mark Shea's book actually was the right one for you at that time.
I know.
That he was answering those questions. So, so now, based upon your experience of going from Islam through a lot of steps to Catholicism. Do you have any advice for Catholics who might have Muslim friends or neighbors or coworkers I'm speaking mostly people who would be maybe here in America, because it would be a different culture than if they were in Turkey or something like that, or right. in the West, we'll say. What are some tips maybe they can have of how they can share their faith? Because to me, I've been involved in evangelization, you know, for a long time, but it's almost all been with fallen away Catholics or Protestants. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of like there's this huge wall that would be very difficult to even start to crack. And so do you have any tips on how that could process could be started?
You have the book on old evangelization, right? Is that your
yes.
book? Yes,
yeah.
I did it a while ago. Great tips there. So it works across the board. But I think with Islam, if you ask Muslims about their own religion, that should be the first big step. Because what they've learned is like everything that comes out of the mouth of a Christian is wrong. They're deceived or they're outright lying. So instead, if you could get them to question their own beliefs, like, okay, you say this thing, but why do you believe this? Right. Like you say, Bible is changed. Can you tell me where it is changed? Right. When it is changed, like, does it make sense? So if you could bring them to question their own beliefs and make an effort to learn about Islam, like, I know, like, I don't want to learn about Islam anymore, and it's not really pleasant to learn. But if the Lord gave you the heart, or you have neighbors, like, if you learn a little bit, that little bit about their own religion, that goes a long way, because it shows good intentions on your part. And then they will be willing to talk about Islam, their own religion. And most of them don't even really think about it that much. It's like something they were born into, something they've never questioned. So that's a big part. And most Muslims are really open to talking about religion and politics. And of course, live a Christian, faithful Christian life. The witness is, like, your life as a practicing Christian is an amazing witness. Like, those are my two things. If you could bring them to question and witness, like, your love of your wife, you know,
right.
your children, the way your children behave, the way you behave towards your children, like, these are all amazing witnesses to Muslims.
I'll put a little plug in for a Crisis Publications book, What Every Catholic Should Know About Islam by William Kilpatrick. I don't know if you've read that one or not, but just for learning about Islam and whatnot. And there's a lot of good books out there that you can learn the basics, because I think that's true for all evangelization. You have to understand what the other person believes and then help them to see the errors in what they believe, the inconsistencies. So, okay. So we're going to shift a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're Catholic. What year was it that you were confirmed in the Catholic Church?
2008.
Okay. So it's been 13 years since you've been Catholic. But I know a couple years ago, you wrote a book on the traditional Latin Mass that I put up there, The Beginner's Guide to Traditional Latin Mass.
Right.
And inside joke, but I did check to make sure the missile's on the right side. For those who don't know, the original cover, they made an accident and they had the missal on the wrong side, on the right side of the priest, but he's holding up the host, which means it has to be on the left side of the priest. For traditional Latin Mass geeks, you'll know that. But
you tell that to Dr. Kwasniewski, who actually checked it.
Oh,
yeah, he checked it. And you know, Dr. Alan Fimister.
Yeah.
He's an old friend of mine. He checked, like, nobody caught it except this Facebook Latin Mass geek. You guys know the missile is on the wrong side, right? And I'm like, ah! It's on the wrong side. Like, no.
That's hilarious. Oh, man. I got to give Peter a hard time about that he didn't catch it either. I mean, you know, he's Mr. Latin Mass guy and he didn't even notice. So
I
remember when you put it on Twitter, like, does anybody know what's wrong with this picture? And I jumped in. I was like, I see it. I bet you, though, if you didn't say something was wrong with it, I wouldn't have noticed. It's only because you said something was wrong that I was like, okay, now I can see it. So anyway, the book doesn't have the errors and the cover doesn't have the error anymore. So anyway, who publishes this book?
Angelico.
Okay. Yes. So you wrote this book, which makes me assume that you attended traditional Latin Mass. Is that correct?
Until COVID tied. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now, why did you write this book, though? Like, what made you interested? I should say before that, what made you interested in traditional Latin Mass after being a Catholic, for a number of years, obviously, just in ordinary form and whatnot?
So when right after I got confirmed in England, I started to attend the Dominican Rite Mass in England. Mm-hmm. And that's where, I don't know if this is from, like, partially because I grew up Muslim, and you know, if Muslims do anything, they do awe and reverence well.
Right.
So maybe partially because I grew up in that, and that's what I expected from a worship. But partially, mostly because I struggle with pride, like, you know, everybody struggles with sin, and I just need a God before whom I can kneel. And when I went to a Latin Mass for the first time, I'm like, yes, you know, now I can fall to my knees. Like I never felt that in the Protestant church, like when Jesus is treated like this teddy bear buddy. I'm like, yes, he died for us, but we can't pull him down to our own level. Like he can, you know, condescend, but we can't pull him down. Right. That's how I felt like what we were doing. And similar with the new Mass, especially the ones I attended in America, I had to say. So I started attending that. And when I got married and I moved here in the diocese I live in, not happy, you know? I mean, there were no clown masses. It wasn't so bad, but it just didn't feel the same reverence. And things have happened. It's a long story, but we ended up going to a Latin Mass, which is 1 hour, 20 minutes away from where we live, because like, how are we going to catechize our children in this? That we are the weird family with four kids. We only had four back then. I mean, four isn't even that many. So, and my husband similarly started to read a lot more about Latin Mass. So we are like, okay, we're going to make the jump. So we drive there and we are like, I was familiar, but my husband wasn't. He's like, is this the easiest thing? You know, the red missile.
Yes, right.
If you don't know anything, even that is confusing. He's like, we have to find something that's a lot easier. So there wasn't anything. So we came up with it. And Chris Lewis, our excellent illustrator, Baritus Catholic is his brand name. So anyway, so that's how we ended up with the guide, but that's how we also started going to Latin Mass. And we went there until COVID started. We're going to a wonderfully celebrated new Mass right now to support a wonderful priest. But I think our heart is always with the Latin Mass.
So you went from praying in Arabic to praying in Latin is basically what you're saying.
Latin is easier.
Yeah.
It's much easier.
There you go. I want to wrap it up here pretty soon, but I also wanted to ask you, so you have a PhD, correct?
Yes.
And so obviously you're very well educated. You talked about earlier about how your mom working and then, but yet having all the responsibilities at home was very difficult for you to see. Right. Like, has it been difficult for you though to kind of shift from, you went from being, you know, on a track to being a very successful professional woman. I mean, obviously you had all this education you could have done. If you just stayed atheist or Muslim, whatever, you probably would have been very successful in the business world if you wanted to be. So now you've shifted, you're a stay-at-home homeschooling mom of five. How is that, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of how I want to ask the question, but like, has that been difficult for you? And do you have any, feelings of regret that about your education and not using it or anything like that?
It hasn't been easy because I never wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, if that's the right phrase.
Yes.
My husband and I, we agreed that there should be at least one parent staying with the kids. Like, we never wanted to do the daycare or a stranger raise our children. And of course it came down for me to be because, you know, I'm breastfeeding and, you know, like it's just when, especially when they're little, like mom needs to be there. I just didn't know this, of course.
Right.
And it was a really hard change for me to put that all away because without even realizing we buy into all those feminist lies, like as if it's like, you're not as worthy if you stay at home or, you know, like. And you know what? It's not fun always. Like, I don't want to make Lego towers all day long. Like, you know, it's just, you know, it's not intellectually stimulating always. Like, especially when they're little. Now that my oldest is 10 and he's asking a lot, you know, complicated questions, it's just so much, you know, easier for me. But I didn't do it because it was easy or easier, but because it was good. And the Lord brought me there, you know, emotionally. And I, like, looking back, and it was the best decision for my children. I can see that. And I can also see the difference between children whose moms stayed home and whose moms didn't. And I understand that it's not a choice always. Unfortunately, like, some moms, they have to work. But our presence is so much more important. Like, you know, we are the center of their universe. Like, again, I can see these looking back, but I would like to encourage young women to, like, consider staying up at home with their kids, especially when they're younger, or at least one parent be always present with the kids.
Yeah, it's just, I know in my own family, my wife staying home throughout, I mean, she's always been a stay-at-home mom since we had our first kid. And it just, I just think it's the, I'm so thankful that, you know, she wanted to do that and we were able to do that, you know, financially, right, and everything. And I know my kids, because I have some now that are growing up and out of the house, and I know they're very thankful. In fact, it was very sweet on, I think it was last Mother's Day or maybe it was birthday, almost the same day with my wife, but my two of my daughters gave her a picture of them, and it had a quote from, I think it was, now I can't remember who it's from, but it was basically saying the sacrifices a mom makes for her children is similar to, you know, it joins in with the sacrifice that God makes, or that Christ made for us. And it was just very beautiful because it showed they appreciated how much, because you don't feel that appreciation when they're 6 years old or whatever the case may be.
No.
But it really has such a dramatic impact on their lives. So, I mean, that's just beautiful. Okay, well, let's wrap it up there. What I want to do is, so first of all, let's make sure I mention the books, from Islam to Christ, not the other way around, from Islam to Christ. And that's Ignatius, correct?
Yes.
Ignatius Press. I'll put links to these books in the show notes. And then we also have A Beginner's Guide to the Traditional Latin Mass, which is somewhat fitting these days, and that's from Angelico Press. And then you also, though, I believe, have another book coming out soon, or it's already out. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's called At His Feet. Actually, I talk about what happens after you convert as a woman. Like, after having believed all these lies, now you're a Catholic woman trying to raise kids. Like, how do you become, you know, this amazing woman suddenly? So I took 12 women from the New Testament, and I looked at their lives, and I tried to encourage other women to take their example up in different ways in our lives, whether you're married, mother, single, you know, wherever you're in your life. So it's a scripture study for women. And I also share my personal experiences, especially after I became a mother and became a wife, and how I kind of traveled through this journey on my own. It's called At His Feet and published by Our Sunday Visitor.
And is it already out, or is it going to be out soon?
Oh, it's out. Yes.
It is out. Okay. Our Sunday Visitor. And I'll make sure I have a link to that. And it's At His Feet. Okay, great. That's awesome. And where can people find out more about all the stuff you're doing?
I'm on all the social media because I have so much free time with five children. And also, I try to update my website quite often, daddyalittle.com.
Okay, great. And I'll put that, of course, a link to that, obviously, in the show notes. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Daria, for being on the show. I mean, honestly, I felt like this one, I was like, I want this one going for 3 hours, but I try to keep them under an hour for, you know, for listeners and everything. But because it's just a fascinating story. But I really encourage people to buy your book, From Islam to Christ. It is excellent. Like I said, I don't have my copy anymore because obviously I let somebody borrow it. So just go ahead and I'll go buy another one now. And but people, get that book. It's a great one. So thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Okay, everybody. Until next time, God love you.